Welcome to Latte with a Lawyer, a podcast dedicated to bringing you the stories of some of America's most successful lawyers, figuring out what makes them tick, how they creatively solve problems, and how others aspiring to be them can follow in their footsteps.
Good morning, everybody. Welcome to another episode of Latte with a Lawyer. I'm your host, Jonathan Brickman. And this morning from Long Island, we got Matthew Rappaport with the law firm of Falcon, Rappaport, and Berkman. Good morning. How are you?
Good morning. I'm well.
Excellent. Welcome to the show. So what's your favorite morning beverage to get started to go with latte with a lawyer?
So I'm not really a morning beverage guy. I drink some tea sometimes. I'm not a coffee guy. You know, I would say the reason for that is because the adrenaline of crippling, horrible anxiety is the breakfast of champions. You wake up, you shot right out of a cannon. What's in store for me today? It's going to drive me up a wall. That will rocket you right out of bed every day.
All right. So your practice is that exciting. I want to hear about it. Tell us about your practice that gets you so fired up.
So the practice itself, when it was in the early days, it began as a trust estates practice, but I always had a passion for the income tax. So after procuring a lot of these deals and holding myself out there as doing these deals, effectively, the way it worked was I started to get a lot of income tax work in, and it started to overwhelm the trust and estate work. So I still do trust and estates. I like trust and estates when it has to do with tax, when it has to do with fiduciary income tax issues, generational wealth transfer issues, and a few other things. But what I really, get into is, you know, all matter of small business M&A, real estate, family businesses, generational wealth transfer, and those sorts of things. And oftentimes what I'm doing is I'm supplementing other professionals. So I am working alongside my colleagues here. Our firm in particular holds itself out as working well in a sandbox with others. So oftentimes we're co-counseling and we're working with accountants, we're working with bankers, we're working with people in the wealth management industry and all sorts of others to put something together that will leave someone in an advantaged position is the goal. That you're planning into something that is usually something the government allows you to do. Section 1031 exchange, qualified opportunity zone investment, various types of qualified trusts, and all sorts of things like that where it's available to you. It's just that you're going to need to put the right pieces in place to be able to qualify or to be able to notch the objective that you're looking for.
Okay. Interesting. Okay, very good. So your day is spent doing what typically? Like, what's your typical day look like? If there is
at one? This point, I was having a conversation the other day. A buddy of mine works for a Fortune 500 company. And I was having a conversation with him the other day about one of the blog posts that changed my life. I don't know if you are familiar with the founder of Y Combinator or one of the founders of Y Combinator, Paul Graham.
Yeah.
Paul Graham has a cool blog. And given that we started this firm about, you know, 4-ish years ago, the firm in many ways is a startup. And listening to some of Paul Graham's wisdom on startups and maturing startups into full-blown businesses has been really helpful. One of his blog posts has to do with the topic of maker schedule versus manager schedule. And that can be applied to law firms all the same. So what he described in that post was a maker schedule is for someone who is toiling away all the time making product. So by that, I mean, if you work in a factory, there are the line workers who literally operate the machinery. And then there's upper management who is responsible for ensuring the macro function of the factory itself. When I was younger and when my practice first started and when the activity was a lot lighter, I had a maker schedule. And by that, I mean, every now and again, I'll be interrupted with a phone call. I'll take a meeting. I'll have something unexpected come up or the like. That's a maker schedule, right? But the manager schedule, on the other hand, is accounted for wall to wall, start to the end of the day. Every moment of it, more or less, is accounted for. You have a lot of meetings. Management ends up doing meetings with tons of people, and you just have to be part of it because you have a certain responsibility. So I began with a maker schedule, but now I have a manager schedule. At any given time, on any given day, I will have almost the entirety of the day booked out with various meetings and phone calls. So I used to, when I was younger, I used to go to the doctor. I used to wonder, like, why can't the doctor just pick up the phone and speak to me when I call? Or why can't the doctor just take me the next day? And it's like, that's not how it works. When you call a doctor's office at any given time, the doctor has the same type of schedule where the doctor's got to run her practice, she's got to see her patients, and she's got to reserve things to get some essential work done that she has to do herself. But furthermore, she has to reserve time for certain emergencies. And for me, my day is client meetings, internal meetings that include management meetings. They include meetings to supervise my staff. They include project management meetings. But the day is meetings, and the work is largely and almost completely delegated, to the point where, sure, you have to exercise supervisory responsibility. And I'm governed, by the way, by two ethics structures, which for a lot of people, to wrap your head around it, is a little bit crazy. But I'm not only governed by the New York State Rules of Professional Conduct, I am governed by IRS Circular 230. Both of those ethical dictates hold me responsible for supervising my staff. They hold me responsible for making sure that the work is done right, it's done on time, that the overall apparatus is running so that you're getting the right output to people at the right time. And managing that is difficult. It requires a lot of regimentation. It requires, for me, when the pandemic started, it got to the point where I had to be so strict, and I still do, but it really started about 3 years ago. I had to be so strict with the way every moment of every day was accounted for that you end up planning things that you never would have thought you needed to plan for the sake of efficiency. Like, when and for how long do I take a shower? You know, when you're in the early parts of your career and you don't have that much going on, and you know, listen, for anybody who's listening to this who's in the AmLaw 100, you're down to that point, you know, from pretty much day one. But if you're at a mid-sized firm, you're at a smaller firm, and you're not at a firm whose culture is like, you know, build 2,200 hours minimum every year or something like that, you're at the point where you say, well, you know, I'll wake up, do what I got to do. Lawyers are notoriously late to the office. You're in there 9:45 in the morning. And in general, there doesn't need to be that much thought and that much structure. But a surprising amount of my mental willpower is, when do I shower? When do I eat? When do I go to the gym? Or when do I work out? I mean, sometimes I'm not even going to the gym. Sometimes I have I don't even ride the Peloton bike. My wife rides the Peloton bike. I use the app. The app has like really efficient 10-minute workouts. When am I putting that on my screen? I don't know. You know? So when am I doing that? And then you talk about having a family and spending time with your family and making sure that that doesn't pass you by, you don't miss it. You squeeze all these things in, and it's like, you got to be hyper efficient every moment of every day. It's a lot of pressure. So for me, it's scheduling all these meetings, making sure my calendar is efficient. It's the day is filled with client meetings, management meetings, and you got to program in, like, I try to program in one 45-minute break every day, one. And sometimes you just can't take it, but I try to do that. And you put a lot of thought into things that you never would have had to put a lot of thought into. And that's every weekday for me, every single weekday. without fail.
Well, this discussion is more about time management and managing a busy schedule as opposed to the practice. I was really asking you about, like, what is your law practice consist of? But this discussion is actually quite interesting. So it sounds like you get a very busy practice, and your role is to manage it and make sure the trains are on time and all that good stuff. And you should read the book E-Myth if you haven't read that. It was out decades ago, but it's similar to your concept about...
I got to pick that back up, tell you the truth, because there's an attorney version.
Oh, is there?
Oh, yeah. You never seen that, the E-Myth attorney?
No. But I read that years ago, but it was about...
The E-Myth attorney, they adapted the E-Myth for attorneys. The book exists. You got to start with why in your background. Is that Simon Sinek or Tim Urban?
Ah, Simon Sinek.
That's Simon Sinek.
Yeah.
He did Leaders Eat Last. I like Simon
Sinek. So you're more of a business. It sounds like you're more of a business guy than a lawyer.
Let me tell you something, okay? My philosophy really is that if your name is on a door at a place, you're a business person. Although, to tell you the truth, I mean, the way that we do it in our office is you have the option to be a business person if you want. If a woman comes in, you know, gets hired as a lawyer with us, whether she's experienced or she isn't, you are given, she's given the option when she enters the firm, you want to be a businesswoman or you want to be a peer practitioner? Because we could use both. There's a place for both. But as far as I'm concerned, your name's on the door. You're a business person. You run a business. You don't run a pure practice. I mean, in my mind, that's the stuff of 40 years ago. That's the stuff of before I was born. I don't want to age anybody or anything. But, like, that's the stuff of before I was born. You run a business. Every single day of my life, I walk into my office, sometimes proverbially, because today I'm working virtually. But every day that I am working in this law firm, I realize I have a solemn responsibility to every single person who works in it. And that was really acute when COVID first hit. You know, in my mind, you could tell what people really thought about their workplaces and their coworkers in terms of how they responded to it. What's your responsibility, really? Because the way that we saw it, and I say we because I speak for all my partners, the way that we saw it is that we saw it first and foremost as a responsibility not only to protect the livelihoods of the people who work with us, but to protect their health. And for me, I see it as you're part of running this business. It's your responsibility to make sure the mouths are fed, to make sure that people have the runway necessary, they got the equipment necessary, they have the infrastructure necessary, the hard infrastructure and the soft infrastructure. The hard infrastructure is you got to make sure that they have the equipment, you have to make sure that they have the resources, you have to make sure that they're being paid market value, you got to make sure all those different things. And the soft infrastructure is operations, that they got to have an open door, that if something is going to be a problem or needs to be corrected or tweaked or otherwise changed, they have an avenue to be able to contact the right person and start the process of being able to bring that into line. And that is, to me, a super important consideration that you have to remember that once you're working with anyone whose name is not also on a door with you, once you're working with anyone, you're a responsibility to that person. You're a responsibility to everyone. You have a responsibility to make sure that they're safe, that they're protected, that they're being nurtured, mentored, that they're growing, that they're paid right, that they get the exposure to things that interest them and challenge them. And that goes for every business on the planet Earth. It doesn't just go for law firms. And in my mind, if you're not looking at your law firm as a living, breathing business, you're not doing it right. It's my take.
Yeah, it's interesting. Yeah, because my dad was a doctor and same with lawyers. I mean, they didn't really run it like a business years ago. Now you guys run it like a business, which it should be. It's a business. But let me ask you a question. So aside from, I want to get a sense of what your practice is. I mean, I know you like taxes and estate planning and wealth management kind of stuff, but the firm does a lot more than that, right? What else does the firm do?
Well, the firm itself at this point, you start losing track. It's, you know, the value proposition that we give to people, the value proposition that we give to laterals is come to this place because we're a team here. We set up all the incentives and we set up the infrastructure so that you can be fairly compensated for what you're doing, but you don't have to deal with the BS. And the thing about law firms is it's a lot of BS, that you try to put personalities in the room that are collaborative, that are working toward a common goal, that don't hinder and get in the way of each other's progress because one person's progress is going to cost another person's progress. It's not the way we view it here. The way we view it here is everybody's progress benefits everybody, that it's a big we before me. And that proposition really resonated with the right people. It was a little self-selecting. So when you talk about the breadth of practice areas, we had our eyes on things because when we started, it was real estate, trust estates, corporate, tax, and litigation that really ran the gamut of not only the traditional litigation topics, but also things that had to do with the transactional work that we did here, estate administration and contested estates, having to do with contract disputes, real estate disputes. And a lot of these things are centered on tax adjacent topics. So the fact that you have the tax knowledge in-house is the type of thing that is helpful when you're trying to get an optimal solution to a problem. So we began with some decent breadth, and we began with like eight lawyers. Now,
the core of your business built around tax. Is that right? Is that a fair statement?
The flagships, I would say, if you were to look at the flagships here, transactional flagships are tax and corporate. We got a strong real estate department, but if you were all right, look at it by revenue, it's tax and corporate. If you look at it by not just revenue, I guess, I would say tax and corporate is still the transactional selling points. In litigation, I would say probably the most common litigation topic that we get into here is business and commercial. But
what are the issues there on litigation that you're litigating?
I would say in a business world,
yeah,
partnership breakups. People go in as business partners and things are all good, but then when events unfold during the course of the partnership, people's lives drift apart, their business vision differs, their circumstances change, they want out of business with each other. But at the same time, marriage and business ventures are like warm beds, nice and easy to get into and really difficult to get out of. And litigation, we focus very heavily on constructive solutions of trying to get people out of bed with each other. Sometimes we take dispute resolution engagements as neutrals. Sometimes it's us, and then the other sides are already represented by counsel, but they just can't come up with a collaborative solution because they've got limited knowledge bases, especially litigators who are not deal lawyers. So on business litigation, we're doing a lot of partnership breakups. There is also a pretty good helping of non-patent IP litigation. Our partner Moish Peltz is an IP litigator by trade. There's a few other people in the firm with some good experience doing it. IP is pretty common. And then you got estate litigation and matrimonial litigation are the two parts of litigation where nobody's rational. You know, in business litigation, people are rational. People are okay distancing themselves from business issues and looking at it rationally. You can let emotions get in the way. It's very common, especially when the business also involves family. But when you're in the business world, you have a good chance, it's not a guarantee, but you have a good chance that rationality will prevail among all parties, especially when you have good lawyers involved. On the other hand, the estate world involves almost exclusively raw emotion. There is no rationality there. It's deep-rooted issues that are probably best sorted out with a shrink being played out in a courtroom. And there is a grand desire a lot of the time of family members to make other family members suffer. That raises the expression that my old boss used to have, where she said, around these parts, I say, Family. It's the other F word.
So give me, you must have some colorful cases you work in. Give me an example of one that stands out.
Well, I don't want to comment on anything that's ongoing. There's a
There's
a couple of things that come to mind about what's ongoing, but I'll give you something that's litigation oriented that was right at the start of the firm where we were able to achieve a pretty good outcome. When the firm first began, we were approached by a wealth advisor that we were friendly with, and he had a client who was co-fiduciary of an estate. And the way it worked was he was sole fiduciary of some of the instruments, the estate, there were several trusts involved. Sometimes he was co-fiduciary on some of these. And as it happened, the estate part of it was still open and heavily contested. The client's brother was all over him. So the estate owned a couple of different entities. The entities held real estate. So you had an LLC on the one hand, you had two S corps on the other hand. And it was November, it was early November 2018. And the client came to us and said, I've been told by my accountant, the accountant was someone good who we worked with. I've been told by my accountant I got to liquidate this S corporation by the end of the year because we just sold real estate out of it. And if we don't liquidate, we're going to end up with an adverse tax outcome. And I said, oh, I said, well, you know, what type of timeline are we looking at? And he said, well, we're on a fiscal year for the estate, which ends at the end of this month. And it ended up being a engagement where we had to liquidate the S corp, except that we found out the S corp still had property in it. So we had to navigate around the idea that even though the S corp sold real estate, still had a note receivable, it had another smaller parcel of real estate, and the corporation needed to go through the proper procedures to liquidate within 3 weeks. It needed to look at the note, look at the real estate, make sure that everything had been transferred properly. It was to achieve a tax outcome, which we had to analyze. And it was to ultimately avoid all of the problems that may arise, the client's brother contesting the estate and being able to question his actions. So we needed to tie together everybody, every named partner in the firm. We needed to put on it, and we needed to take other partners as well and corral them in and have their expertise help solve the issue. But by the end of November, by the time just when we came back from Thanksgiving, we had signatures on all the documents. We had tax analysis prepared for it, and it ended up allowing the client to recognize a multi-million dollar loss and get favorable consequences from the sale of the original real estate. So that's an example of just a really interesting, interdisciplinary, time-sensitive, high-stakes, multi-million dollar sort of potpourri of issues all wrapped up within one matter for one client. And that, when you talk about FRB, that matters FRB for sure.
There you go. There you go. There's your infomercial. Why'd you become a lawyer? I see you went to Georgetown. Is that where you went to undergraduate too?
No, I went to undergraduate at Washington University in St. Louis.
Oh, there you go.
Which is not UW. It's not Wazoo, which is Washington State. It's not St. Louis University.
No, I understand.
It's not George Washington. It's not Georgetown. It is Washington University, but it's in St. Louis.
I understand. I know exactly where it is. So, okay, so why did you become a lawyer? You're a character. You could have been a stand-up comedian. I mean, you got a personality.
It might not be too late for me to quit my day job. It might not. It's less stressful, I think. I don't know. It's less stressful. And then you take a look at the whole Tears of a Clown phenomenon. And the notion that, you come to